I hope that Mr. Pompeo can improve on Mr. Tillerson's management of the State Department. But what concerns me more is that, as you've just mentioned, Pompeo has much more hawkish views about Iran and North Korea. Right now, we don't have a nuclear crisis with Iran. But if Mr. Pompeo, as secretary, ends up being a yes man to the president's worst instincts, it's very possible that 2 months from now, we will have two nuclear crises with both Iran and North Korea. And that concerns.
So this by Jennifer Rubin over at The Washington Post. With the appointment of John Bolton as National Security Advisor, who is now, and that's a job that doesn't require the Senate to confirm you, so he's already in that job, and the nomination of Mike Pompeo as Secretary of State, who was just recently confirmed by the Senate, most foreign policy gurus expect that the president is going to try to walk away from the nuclear deal. The name, and you hear this all the time, the Iran deal, the nuclear deal. Here's what it is. The nuclear deal is better known as the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. And the JCPOA has become, just like Obamacare and NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and the Paris Climate Accord, President Trump has little idea what's in it. But President Barack Obama did it, so therefore it must be bad. The stakes involved in abandoning it, though, are much greater and with fewer congressional controls than with other deals that we've had in the past.
John Bolton, derided by Senate Democrats today as the worst possible choice to represent the United States before the United Nations.
There is no such thing as the United Nations.
To prove their point, Democrats played portions of a 1994 speech showing what they call Bolton's disdain for the UN.
Again, the Secretariat building in New York has 38 stories. If you lost 10 stories today, it wouldn't make a bit of difference.
It's hard for me to know why you'd want to work at an institution that you said didn't even exist.
Back during the Bush administration, George W. Bush picked John Bolton to be our secretary to the UN. And it was asked, why did you pick somebody who has a clear record of absolute hatred of the UN? Somebody who actually advocated for blowing the top 10 stories off of the UN building. And this is a common thing among conservatives. This is like the Bill Bennett thing. Bill Bennett ran against the Department of Education. So as soon as Reagan became president, he made him head of the Department of Education. Betsy DeVos effectively did the same thing, ran against public schools. So what do? You put Betsy DeVos in charge of public schools. The Justice Department, which deals with a lot of racial and civil rights issues. What do? Well, you put Jeff Sessions in charge. Why? Because he clearly is against civil rights. He clearly has a problem with race. So, and when it comes to the UN, of course, the Republican Party, and this is a well-known thing, and they're not quiet about it. When it comes to anything that's united, unions, the United States, the United Nations, democracy, anything that's united, they absolutely cannot stand it. Remember, the name of the game is rugged individualism. Person, person, person. There's no society. We're merely a bunch of individuals sort of acting on our own in the same kind of spaces, but not really working together, because that would be bad. So this by Susan Maloney over at the Brookings Institution, the lurch toward a more intransigent U.S. national security team only compounds the challenge for America's partners in the deal. Referring to the nuclear deal. Britain, France, and Germany, whose diplomats have been frantically trying to devise a supplemental pact that meets Trump's demands while avoiding an explicit violation of the existing nuclear agreement. If the European effort fails, and it is a fair bet that it will, Trump has pledged to terminate the agreement in May. This is coming up next month. Washington must recognize that the costs of American abrogation of the nuclear deal will not be borne by Iran alone. Terminating the JCPOA will corrode any prospect of sustaining Iranian compliance with the deal's constraints on its nuclear program, as well as the transparency provided via the deal's rigorous inspection regime. The collapse of the deal will reverberate across the landscape of American interest and influence, generating a transatlantic rift, at least as acrimonious as that incited by the 2003 Iraq War, undermining multilateral diplomacy around other urgent crises such as North Korea, and bolstering Russian and Chinese influence in the Middle East. Many project that the end of the nuclear deal would launch an inexorable march toward a direct military conflict with Iran, with ruinous consequences for regional stability and the global economy. So that first clip I was talking about, walking away from the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, that will allow Iran to develop a nuke. Yeah, I know what you're hearing on conservative outlets. I know what you're hearing from Fox. I know what you're hearing from President Dum Dum. But walking away from that deal will lead to them getting a bomb, will lead to them getting a nuclear weapon. I don't want to get into all the details of it because it's fairly long. But we are allowed to do inspections, effectively any kind of inspections that we want. And the kind of turbines that you need to enrich uranium to the level that would be needed to make a nuclear weapon, they're not allowed to even possess. So it's a pretty good deal. I hear Trump talking all the time about, yeah, but what about their missiles and this? No, 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 no. It doesn't completely disarm that country, but it stops them from getting a nuclear weapon. And here's the other thing. If we walk away from the nuclear deal, so President Obama helps negotiate it, and then Dum Dum becomes president, he walks away from it. What you're saying to any country where we make a deal with them is that deal is not going to necessarily be any good when the next guy comes along.
The point that I want to leave with you in this very brief presentation is where I started, is there is no United Nations. There is an international community that occasionally can be led by the only real power left in the world, and that's the United States, when it suits our interests and when we can get others to go along. The Secretariat building in New York has 38 stories. If you lost 10 stories today, it would make a bit of difference. This kind of mindless creation of the United Nations as something different from what it's in the United States' interest to do isn't going to sell here or anywhere else. The United States makes the UN work when it wants it to work. And that is exactly the way it should be, because the only question to the United States is what's in our national interest. And if you don't like that, I'm sorry, but that is the fact.
John Bolton, National Security Advisor, worked for the George W. Bush administration. Mike Pompeo, who is somebody who's terribly racist, he's also anti-Muslim, and he's also anti-gay, and he loves the idea. Our top diplomat is now this man who believes in the idea of war. So this particular president that ran against the idea of stupid wars, his term, not mine, of course, I used those terms at one time. The wars have been going on for so long, though, I don't even think about the fact that they're happening. And I think that's by design. That's kind of the point. But it would appear that this particular president that ran against stupid wars is building a war cabinet now and beginning what I'm referring to as the war on peace. And maybe all of a sudden he's got all this power and doesn't know what to do with it. Maybe, just maybe, he realizes how much more powerful the leader of a country becomes once they decide to start a war. Dennis Ross at the Post writes that walking away from the nuclear deal gives the illusion of toughness on Iran without the effect. He goes on to explain, the danger that Iran possesses is its expansion in the region. It is using Shiite militia proxies to gain a stronghold over governments. It is embedding itself militarily in Syria, even trying to change the demographic balance by importing Shiite militias and Shiite civilians to populate Sunni areas. Something designed to prevent refugees from returning to their homes, but also something likely to ensure an ongoing insurgency in Syria. Worse, Iran seems increasingly less risk-averse in Syria. It acted out of character when it chose to challenge Israel directly, and not through one of its proxies, when it flew a drone into Israeli airspace, containing the spread of the Iranians, their proxies, and the development of the military capability in Syria should be the Trump administration's focal point, but it's not, with Trump making clear that he wants to let other people take care of it now. It's also worth remembering the hashtag 47 traitors thing. When Barack Obama, and that's the problem with the Iran deal, the JCPOA. It's the only thing that conservatives don't like about it. Is it something that Barack Obama gets credit for? And back when it was being hammered out, hashtag 47 traitors, 47 Republican Senate members, GOP Senate members, wrote a letter to Iran and said, "Do not take this deal." They wrote directly to their government and said, "Do not take this deal." Effectively, what Nixon did during the election of 68, saying, "Don't take this deal from LBJ. When I become president, I will give you a better deal." And that's what the 47 traitors were saying. Don't do this. When someone else comes along, we will give you a different deal, a better deal. So now it appears that we're hurling. You need not worry. Worrying is useless. But I want you to be conscious of this stuff. We now seem to be somewhat hurling towards nuclear war with either Iran or North Korea. We'll get into North Korea a little bit later. So with that, enter a seemingly unlikely hero, Macron.
And nationalism. But closing the door to the word will not stop the evolution of the word. Commercial war is not the proper answer. We are killing our planet. Let us face it. There is no planet B. I'm sure one day the United States will come back and join the Paris Agreement to protect our democracies. We have to fight against the ever-growing virus of fake news, which exposes our people to irrational fear and imaginary risks.
So something happened when Macron was visiting. He seemed to be, and this was the way it was described on all the major news outlets, CNN, MSNBC, a bromance. He's having a bromance with the president. You know, they're backslapping and they're chuckling and they're, you know, they're razzing each other. And I don't know what else. Bromance. Okay. And they go, "Wow, the bloody hell is Macron doing?" From what we know about Macron, he's fairly different from our president. One, he's got a brain in his head. And the differences just go on from there. It's like, what the hell is Macron doing? Then Macron got to get up in front of a joint session of Congress. A lot of you are going to forget. So allow me to remind you about how amazing, how stunning it is that this happened and that anybody even responded to it when it did. Does anybody remember Freedom Fries? Here's what happens when the United States gets hawkish and decides that we're going to go to war. We appeal to the United Nations. We want war in Iraq. The United Nations said, "No, no, no. Let's put weapons inspectors on the ground. Let's see if those weapons are really in there." And Bush said, "Okay." And we put up with it for a little bit. But the thing about inspecting for weapons, there's not a lot of killing involved in that. And so in March 2003, Bush said, "Get them all out of there. We're bombing the hell out of that country. We're done looking for weapons." The French were one of the loudest voices telling us, "Don't do this. It's a mistake. You're going to get bogged down in a quagmire. It's going to cost trillions of dollars. France was one of the loudest voices on this. And we decided in America that because we wanted blood after 9/11 and that we had been putting ourselves on a war footing since that Tuesday morning in September, we decided that the French were clearly un-American. They stink, they talk funny, and we hate them. Do we have anything French in America? There were people all over the place breaking their French-made products, pouring their French wine down the drain for America. And fries, they go, oh, God, love it. We've got French fries in every restaurant in America. What are we going to do about it? Clearly, France has already invaded our restaurants. And some schmuck somewhere came up with the idea of changing them from French fries. I don't call them that, by the way. I think everyone just calls them fries. I don't call them French fries. I don't think they're French. Whatever. Decided that we're going to call them freedom fries. Because when we go to war and we slaughter people, or we help facilitate slaughter, that's freedom. So this guy comes up with freedom fries, and he goes on the Sean Hannity show. He goes on the Rush Limbaugh show. He goes on Fox News. He gets millions that adore him. Freedom fries. We hate the French so much. And then here comes Macron to get in front of Congress and says all of these things that absolutely just rebuff everything that Trump believes in. After this bromance of several days, just point by point by point, bam, 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 just chipping away at every dumb thing that Trump believes in the House, in the Senate, although I can't imagine a lot of Republicans, she stood up and applauded. Yeah, we agree with you.
The United States and the American people are an essential part of our confidence in the future, in democracy, in what women and men can accomplish in this world when we are driven by high ideals and an unbreakable trust in humanity and progress. Today, the call we hear is the call of history. This is a time of determination and courage. What we cherish is at stake. What we love is in danger. We have no choice but to prevail. And together we shall prevail.
In the absence of leadership, and that's definitely what we're dealing with right now, Our senators and our House members don't want to be leaders. They like the money, they like the job, but they don't really want to be leaders. And of course, President Donald Trump doesn't know which way is up. And so it creates this void. And I think what has happened with Macron is he has popped into that void because, see, he realizes that the world at large is in danger here. If we decide that we're going to talk to North Korea and screw it up. Trump doesn't, come on. Okay, I don't know the way forward with North Korea. I don't know everything about North Korea. I don't particularly know what to do with North Korea. So I cannot say right here, right now, on this microphone, let's do this instead because Trump is so dumb, he should do this. I don't know what to do. I can admit that. I don't have the answer. But here's the other thing that I know. The thing that I definitely know. Donald freaking Trump does not have the answer. Ripping people off and banging porn stars does not give you insight into North Korea. So I think what Macron was doing By first of all, just playing up to Trump and then getting on stage and just rebuffing everything that Trump believes in. And then he got down to business, the JCPOA, because he realizes that if we walk away from this, it's going to arm Iran. If it arms Iran, they're not just going to have a bomb that reaches the U.S. They have a bomb that reaches the U.K. also. Mutually assured destruction. And in the absence of leadership, Macron is doing his best to try to save the rest of us.
There is an existing framework called the JCPOA to control the nuclear activity of Iran. We signed it at the initiative of the United States. We signed it, both the United States and France. That is why we cannot say we should get rid of it like that. But it is true to say that this agreement may not address all concerns, and very important concerns. This is true. But we should not abandon it without having something substantial and more substantial instead. That's my position.
It's hard to tell exactly how this is going to turn out, but I like what Macron is doing right now. So keep an eye open. And we're going to do the same here at the show. North Korea and South Korea are already having meetings. And I'll admit this. Donald Trump might have had something to do with that. I don't think Trump was thinking to himself, I know exactly what to do, and then did it, and things are turning out the way that he wants them. He's patting himself on the back, and fine, let him think whatever he wants. But I think what North Korea, the North Korea leader, Kim Jong-un, realized is, oh my God, this guy doesn't care about anybody. He's going to get his country wiped out. He's going to wipe out my country. He's going to destroy the whole planet. He doesn't care. And I think that when Kim Jong-un realized that he was dealing with somebody even more dangerous than himself, that's when he decided, you know what? Maybe talking isn't going to be so bad.
What we cherish is at stake. What we love is in danger. We have no choice but to prevail. And together, we shall prevail.
Because Donald Trump has no idea what he's doing. We're in uncharted territory for sure. And we don't know how it's going to turn out. But man, is this commentator's eyes going to be open in the coming weeks? Hoping that we don't walk away from that deal.
You have to look at what we have. I watched Stormy Daniels say that the president of the United States had unprotected sex with her. That makes me question your. If you're a 60-year-old man and you don't care about gonorrhea, how can you worry about North Korea? Like literally, how?
We've got about 2 weeks. 2 weeks until we're supposed to recertify the Iran nuclear deal. If we walk away from it, we don't know what's going to happen. If we stick with it, it's just carry on as you were. Let's see what happens.
The less we have in common, the stronger we are. Is a marriage stronger when spouses have radically different beliefs? Are you closer to your kids when you share no common points of reference? Do you speak the same language as your best friend? Could you be best friends if you didn't? These are important questions, given that our leaders are radically and permanently changing our country, wholly on the basis of their faith that diversity is, in fact, our strength. Maybe we should have talked this through ahead of time. Somehow we didn't.
So that's Tucker Carlson over at Fox News complaining about diversity. If you spend any amount of time listening to conservative media, you'll find that they do not like the brown-skinned folks. They definitely don't like the gay folks. And they most certainly don't like diversity. You know what else? They don't like the feminists. They just don't. They hate everything, seemingly. And then they turn to the camera and they look directly into it, and they go, why do liberals hate everything? It's pretty insane, right? Backwards world. So Trump, doing what he can to bolster his base, right? We keep hearing about this blue wave. Here comes the blue wave. Realizing that that blue wave might be coming, and realizing that he just needs to get back in campaign mode and get those same people, just the people that voted for him, right? Just the 56 million people that voted for him, right? Yeah, he lost by 3 million votes, fine. But those people, you know, those people that turned out, just get those same people to turn out for him again, and everything's going to be okay. And he thinks back to 2016. He goes, what did I do? Oh, wait, I did lots of racist stuff. So what I need to do, 2018, James, 2016, I need to do lots and lots of racist stuff. Get those same racists to come out, get their racist backs up, win all over again. Okay, here we go. So it's every day he's trying something new. Screaming about the wall. Screaming about diversity. So look at Chicago, the black men with the guns. Look. Always with something racist. Because he won that way. No, I don't think he won because of his racism. But it certainly helped get a few more people out. And considering who the Democrats had, they just, well, whatever, let the racist guy win. That's fine. Let's have racism for a few years. That's fine. And so Trump's almost running out of racist things to do. God, what brown skin group have I not attacked yet? I feel like he says that into the open air. What brown skin group have I not slighted yet? And I imagine someone, maybe Stephen Miller, who knows, just sort of crawls out of a mouse hole, right? With like a raw piece of meat between his teeth. He takes his grubby claw hands, he pulls the raw meat from his mouth, and he goes, boss, you have not slighted Native Americans yet. Native Americans, but they've got Americans right in their name. But boss, their skin, it's brown. Trump has this light bulb moment. So here it goes. This from Politico by Dan Diamond. The headline, Trump challenges Native Americans' historical standing. What the flippin' hell? A lot of you can't see me. And that's good. It's face for radio and all the rest. But I'm Native American. Nice tan skin. You know, I'm not full, but I got the tan skin and the black hair and all the rest. Black stringy hair when it grows in. My head's shaved right now because the white part of me is going bald. I'm quoting here. The Trump administration says Native Americans might need to get a job if they want to keep their health care, a policy that tribal leaders say will threaten access to health care and reverse centuries-old protections. I'll go back to quoting this in a moment, but here's the way it goes. After the Trail of Tears and all these other terrible things with the Indians, just slaughtering them and raping their women and all the rest. Once we began settling in, we said, okay, you can have this piece of land, you can have that piece of land. I remember my mom and all her brothers and sisters, or sister, all got a piece of land after her dad died. Her dad was full Native American. They all got a piece of land because he got a piece of land. You know, lots of the Native Americans were given a piece of land. And my grandfather, my mom's dad, who I never got to meet, he broke his land up between his seven kids, and then they all got a piece of land. Most of them have sold their land off or lost their land to eminent domain. I remember hearing that from one of my uncles about he goes, well, they built a freeway through part of it, so I just lost it and I don't get anything for it. So we've been doing that too. And one of the other things that we did on top of giving them land is we gave them sovereignty. You said, you are your own nation. You're a nation inside of a nation, you know, and you can do what, and that's why in Indian casinos, you can do things that you can't, you know, necessarily do in other places. You know, you can do what you want on, and they've got their own stores, they got their own police force, the native police, they got all their own stuff. And we said, you know, you can operate inside this country, but they also get other benefits. They do get benefits from our government because their infrastructure is not what ours is. And what Trump is saying is no more. Remember, President Jackson, the Trail of Tears, Andrew Jackson. That's the guy. And Trump says, they say, which president you like the most? Oh, Andrew Jackson. Oh, Trail of Tears? Are you sure? Oh, yeah. Like that guy. So here he goes. Quoting here, travel leaders want an exception from new Medicaid work rules being introduced into several states. And they say that there are precedents for health care exceptions. Native Americans do not have to pay penalties for not having health coverage under Obamacare's individual mandate, for instance. But the Trump administration contends that the tribes are a race rather than separate governments, and exempting them from Medicaid work rules, which have been approved in three states, are being sought by at least 10 others, would be illegal preferential treatment. The Health and Human Services believes that such an exemption would raise constitutional and federal civil rights law concerns, according to a review by administration lawyers. The tribes insist that any claim of racial preference is moot because they're constitutionally protected as separate governments, dating back to treaties hammered out by President George Washington, reaffirmed in recent decades under Republican and Democratic presidents alike, including the Clintons, and the George W. Bush and Obama administration. The United States has a legal responsibility to provide health care to Native Americans, said Mary Smith, who is acting head of the Indian Health Service during the Obama administration and is a member of the Cherokee Nation. It's the largest prepaid health system in the world. They've paid through land and massacres. And now you're going to take away their health care and add a work requirement? Tribal leaders and public health advocates also worry that Medicaid work rules are just the start. President Donald Trump is eyeing similar changes across the nation's welfare programs, which many of the 3 million Native Americans rely on. It's very troublesome, said Katrin McCarran Choi of the National Indian Health Board, noting that Native Americans suffer from the highest drug overdose death rates, among other health concerns. There's high unemployment in Indian country, and it's going to create a barrier to accessing necessary medical services. Which racial group has Trump not gone after just yet?
Yeah, as you know, Chicago's not an island. And unfortunately, we live half an hour from Indiana. And Indiana has some of the most lax gun laws in the nation. And so this is a national crisis. It's a national tragedy, and it has to have a national response. This can't be solved city by city or even state by state. Our country, unfortunately, I really believe this, values our guns more than we value our children. And that has to change. We as adults have failed, and our kids are going to force the change. They're going to lead us to where we need to go, which is to a safer United States, to a safer society.
So Chicago is often brought up by conservatives for, well, good reason for them. There is a high level of gun violence in Chicago, and Chicago does have tough gun laws. But as pointed out in that particular clip, the areas that surround Chicago, the states that surround Chicago, they don't have those same tough gun laws. So people just go outside the state, get those guns, and bring them back in. Most of the guns seized in the Chicago area are traced back to those surrounding states that have really loose gun laws. But when conservatives talk about the Chicago gun problem, you know, the Chicago violence problem, all those inner city blacks, like they care. They're pointing, when they've, Chicago, it's like a tick with them. You know, whenever it comes to guns, they just Chicago this, Chicago that. What they're saying is black. The place is full of black people, and it's run by Democrats who are probably also black. Black. So we're led to believe in some strange conservative universe that maybe, just maybe, black people are more prone to violence. I don't think any group, be they white, black, male, female, well, maybe some of our males right now, they all seem to be broken. I think any group is more prone to violence. But I believe that there are circumstances that tend to lead to more violence. And poverty is definitely one of them. I grew up in deep, deep poverty. I'm not ashamed about this, and I have a problem talking about this. And I was surrounded by violence. I have been jumped and mugged more times than I can count. And all of it happened, or a lot of it happened, before I ever even made it into high school. So we're talking 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, just young. Walking down the street would just get jumped by a bunch, just pounded and just left there, you know, reaching in my pockets, take whatever I have, just beaten. And they don't know who I am or even necessarily what I have, but I grew up in the ghetto. And there, by any means necessary. We're going to survive by any means necessary. And the gated communities are too far away. And don't forget, they're gated. So what we do in the hood, we rob each other. So, right, they leave us the crumbs, and we fight each other for the crumbs. That's what I dealt with the whole time growing up. So when you have deep poverty, that leads to more violence. We don't talk about that, though. And when we say Chicago, violence, what they mean is black. And what they're ignoring is that there's, and I'm white, a lot of white people in poverty, too. A lot of white people in those ghettos, too. It's not just African Americans. It traps everybody. Everybody that's born into it. So there's an article over at the Guardian by Donna Ladd from about 3 weeks ago. And the headline, dangerous, growing, yet unnoticed. The rise of America's white gangs. White gangs are less covered by the media and less punished, even though 53% of gang members in Mississippi are white. It goes on to talk about one of the gangs called the Royals, out of Chicago, a white gang, and this gang is still around. Quoting here, the Royals' roots date to Chicago's north side in 1952, when two violent greaser gangs, the Ashland Royals and Simon City, guarded Simon Park turf as Puerto Ricans moved in. Early greasers were immigrants, often Italian, maligned by wealthier whites for greasing machines and blue-collar jobs. In 1968, the Greasers united as the Simon City Royals, often rumbling with the nearby Latin Kings as well as the white supremacist Gaylords. Their rhetoric is familiar. A Gaylords nostalgia website called the Latino Gangs storage bins for illegal immigrants. The Royals were one of the biggest and most violent street gangs in Chicago by the 1970s when they joined the Folk Nation Alliance with the Black Gangster Disciples. By the 1980s, the gang had weakened after its leadership got locked up or killed. Strength then shifted to our prisons. And the brand spread to Midwestern and Southwestern and South and Southern states like Mississippi, where the Royals are now one of the largest and most violent gangs in the state. And it's a white gang. And this isn't a white supremacist gang. That's a whole nother gang. This is just a gang that's largely white. Surveys of young Americans have shown that 40% identifying as gang members are white, but police tend to undercount them to 10 to 14% and overcount black and Hispanic members. This, according to Babe Howell, a criminal law professor at City University of New York, who focuses on crime and race. Police see groups of young white people as individuals, each responsible for his or her own conduct, and hold young people of color in street gangs criminally liable for the conduct of their peers, she says. How law enforcement labels specific gangs may also obscure white membership. A 2012 study published in the Michigan Journal of Race and Law posited, Jordan Blair Woods researched how the feds applied the RICO laws, the Racketeering Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, to various gangs. Congress passed the RICO law in 1970 to target the mafia as organized criminal enterprises. In the early 1990s, the Attorney General Janet Reno started using RICO to charge criminal street gangs. Woods goes on to explain that law enforcement typically splits gang activity into three groups: white supremacist, prison gangs, and outlaw biker clubs and criminal street gangs. He concluded that systematic racism often keeps white gangs categorized as prison and biker groups instead of street gangs. The category drawing the toughest charges and sentences. This means white gangs are not typically policed as stringently, he writes, and their members can miss interventions sometimes offered to more publicized gangs of color. But say gangs, say poverty, say urban, say inner city, say the word Chicago. And what it immediately brings up in most people's minds, and this is by design, is black. Black is the problem. And the racism that I still hear on conservative talk radio, I don't know how they just get away with it, how this is not considered hate speech, how the GOP is not yet labeled as a hate group yet, blows my mind. Clyburn, Congressman Clyburn, is black. He's in the Congressional Black Caucus. All right, these are the folks that focus more on black issues, right? Issues that tend to get ignored by folks who may not have lived in the African-American community, who may not be African-American themselves, okay? It's called the Congressional Black Caucus, or as Rush Limbaugh likes to call it.
This is a CNN Tonight where Don Lemon is talking to Clyburn. He is also a former grand poobah of the Congressional Black Caucasians, the CBC.
The Congressional Black Caucasians. F-F-S. We'll get back to the racial issues on another day. There's another issue we need to talk about. Moving on to our boys.
There is more than just a consensual relationship here that she wants to tell the country about.
There's the act, mm-hmm. and there's the cover up, mm-hmm. and the American people are going to learn about both in the interview and beyond.
Okay.
Michael Avenatti, thank you.
That's a deep tease right there.
That is March 25th.
March 25th.
Yeah.
Week from Sunday. I'll know where I'll be that night.
Yeah. Was she threatened in any way?
Yes.
Was she threatened physical harm?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Keep going, Mika.
There's a common thread among deeply conservative men. Paranoid conservative men. And I'm talking about your InfoWar types. A lot of them seem to have a deep hatred of women. There's women in our society that are okay with it. They date these men, they marry these men, they make children with these men, but their numbers are small. And perhaps identifying with their captors was not a part of their plans, but that is the way that it happens. But most women, the vast majority, are not okay with it. They're not okay with the abuse, they're not okay with the misogyny, they're not okay with plural marriages and dumb things like that. Things that make women the lower class, the lesser sex, or however you want to describe it. So there are, in turn, an awful lot of lonely men out there who have deeply held far right, conservative, paranoid beliefs. And those men, when they end up alone, after expressing those feelings, they begin to blame not themselves when they end up alone. They begin blaming the women themselves. How dare they? How dare they not sleep with us? How dare they not make babies with us? How dare they? 4chan and Reddit are the two main websites in the dark web. You've heard of the dark web. Where these folks like to get together and share their absolute upside down and inside out hatred of women. Because how dare they not sleep with us? It's a gentleman who decided to drive his car onto a sidewalk in Toronto, in Canada, and plowed out a bunch of people. But before he decided to plow those people down, he decided to post on Facebook, calling Roger the Supreme Gentleman. The Facebook post declared, "The incel rebellion has already begun. We will overthrow the Chads and Stacys." So who is Roger, the Supreme Gentleman? Isla Vista, 2014. He killed 6 people and shot himself. And he posted a video manifest, talking about how, you know, he was going to get revenge on women do not find him attractive. And oh my God, he's so lonely and he's sick of masturbating and whatever else. And then he went on to kill a bunch of people. That guy. That loser. And I don't feel like there's a lot of times you can use that kind. That loser is now worshipped in the underground community, the incel community. So who are the incels? Incel stands for involuntary celibate. This is a real thing. Incel.me is one of the places you can read their thoughts. And it is. It's just an absolute woman hate fest. So, incel, quoting it from an article over at the Independent, incel refers, in short, to involuntary celibate and is used in opposition to vossel. People identifying with the name blame women, for not having sex with them or being in relationships with them and spend most of their times advocating against feminism and women more generally. At their most extreme, members of the group have suggested that men should be allowed to rape or physically attack women. Something's being argued for, right? This is sort of a more extreme extension of what Betsy DeVos is arguing for on college campuses. The rest of the words used in the Facebook post are characteristic of the group, the Incel Rebellion. And it's a common idea that members of the group must rise up against the system that they see is unfair to them. Chads and Stacys, chances are you're a Chad. I am a Chad. My wife is a Stacy. Chads and Stacy are sexually active men and women. And the idea is kill them all. Because how dare they? So wait a minute. Extremist, violent, hates feminism, hates women. What we know now from the people that were mowed down on that sidewalk, most of them were women. And it really is that they just hate women. How dare they not sleep with them? Their sensitivities are so badly hurt by the fact that women, but yeah, deeply conservative men coming close, closer, but not too close. Let me tell you the way this works. If you want a woman to love you, and I have a woman that loves me, I have many women that love me. I'm only married to one of them though. If you want a woman to love you, you have to treat her like a human being. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Don't start swinging on me. Just still let me finish. Let me finish, please. You have to treat her equally, right? You have to see her as a human being and not just an F machine, right? Someone that serves you, someone that picks up your dirty drawers, someone that cooks you food. You can't see them that way. You have to see them as human beings. I know, you don't like it. Hey, you like being treated like a human being, don't you? Well, that's the way you gotta treat the ladies. And killing them with your car is not going to get them to love you. Raping them is not going to get them to love you. Catcalling them is not going to get you to love them. Grabbing them by the vagina without their permission is not going to get them to love you. I know, right? This is crazy talk right now. I'm sorry. It's just the way it is. And I know, because I get to be a Chad. But threatening women, God, it's not just the incels that don't seem to have an issue when it comes to threatening women. Who else am I thinking of?
So Michael Cohen, who is Trump's top lawyer and an executive vice president with the Trump Organization, had retweeted, "Let's gut her," about me at a time when the threat level was very high, which he knew. And Bill Shine, an executive vice president at Fox, called him up to say, "You got to stop this. Like, we understand you're angry, but this is, you know, she's got three little kids. She's walking around New York, really." And he didn't much care. And what Bill Shine said to Michael Cohen was, "Let me put it to you in terms you can understand. If Megyn Kelly gets killed, it's not going to help your candidate."
Who else am I thinking of? Man, you know, it'll come to me eventually. It's not coming to me right now, but it'll come to me eventually. The head of the Toronto Police Department has decided to say that at this time, we're not going to focus on that particular thing. Something they're going to look at. But they say, you know what, we don't really know what brought us to this particular point. But we're going to figure out why he did this, and we're going to help fix the problem, and, you know, all the rest. It's right there. He tells you why he did it. Not only does he tell you why he did it, he tells you why it's going to happen again. And so here's what needs to happen to this particular gentleman, and I use the term loosely. When they decide that they're going to mow down people on a sidewalk because they cannot get women to sleep with them, they need these guys, even more than people who use marijuana, these guys need the book thrown at them. They need to be made an example of. They need to realize that this is not acceptable behavior so that they know that they can't do this. And perhaps they won't do this again. You know, perhaps if you shine some light on this, bring it to everyone's attention. And for those that are considering killing a bunch of people because they're horny and they can't go to place to stick it. You need to make them realize that this is not the way to go. It's been at least 6 decades in the making now. But this past week, we finally got some good news on the Me Too front.
It's been a very long journey, but this is an historic result. This was her story. Not his story, not history, but the story of her. The story of Andrea Constant. The story of all of those who took that risk against a rich, powerful, famous man. Took the risk of being denigrated publicly, took the risk of being sued for what they said because he had the resources to do it. And yes, the Me Too movement has arrived and is well and is living in Montgomery County, throughout this nation, and throughout this world. Thank you.
The weeping and celebrating out of Pennsylvania was absolutely out of control. When the jury came back this time, now that we're living in the era of Me Too, last time this went to trial, it was a hung jury. Cosby and his lawyers left. Ha ha ha. Nothing to see here. Cosby has drugged and raped dozens of women. Dozens. But not all of them are prosecutable because a lot of them are outside the statute of limitations. This is one of the few that's still inside the statute. So if this was going to happen to Cosby, it needed to happen now. This past weekend, it did. The jury went away in the era of the Me Too movement, came back very quickly. We don't know if that's good or bad. And then they said guilty on all charges. 10 years for all three charges. If Cosby gets the book thrown at him, and he won't. The judge has already sort of let out that he's not going to give him all 30 years. Because all 30 years would definitely be a death sentence. Whatever Cosby did in his life, and at one time he was called America's father. I watched The Cosby Show. I watched A Different World. I watched all of it. I just loved that TV as a kid. Everything he's done in his life, his comedy, his movies, his TV shows, his positive male role modeling, all this stuff. Just gone, wiped out, because he decided that it was okay. He didn't see women as people. Drug them, have sex with their unconscious bodies, and just go. And that's just, it's okay. Because he did that, at 80, he's now finally paying for it. Yeah, he should have paid for it way sooner, but better late than never. But this effectively, this is what it'll be known for now. When they say the word Bill Cosby, you're not going to think the Leonard movies. You're not going to think the Cosby Show. You're not going to think the, 200 Miles an Hour album. You're going to think about this guy who drugged and raped women. That's the way he's going to be known now. It's unfortunate, but it's also fair because that's the way that he should be known. And in the case, oh my God, Stormy Daniels, here's where we're going to finish this today. Michael Cohen, the president's lawyer, has decided to plead the fifth. What the hell does the president think about that?
When you have your staff taking the Fifth Amendment, taking the fifth so they're not prosecuted.
Fifth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Fifth Amendment.
Horrible. Horrible.
Her staffers taking the Fifth Amendment. How about that? But they have five people taking the Fifth Amendment. Like you see on The Mob, right? You see The Mob takes the fifth. If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment?
When it was Hillary Clinton and Hillary Clinton's staff, he was no okay, okay? But now that it's his lawyer, Michael Cohen, and it's got to do with the Stormy Daniels thing, well, This is another one of those promises not kept, one of those things that he no longer believes in. Michael Cohen has decided to plead the fifth, and we fully anticipated that he's going to do so. And where the hell this is going to go now, it's hard to say. But the president being willing to go on Fox News and give these interviews, these unscripted interviews, he doesn't realize it now. But all of the lawyers that are working for him, in this case and in others, they're doing their absolute best to look out for him, to protect him, and to keep him free. And then he goes on Fox News and just runs off at the mouth and blows up their entire case in 10 seconds. It's hard to say how the year is going to turn out, where we'll be at the end of 2018. But I'm starting to feel like the prediction I've had all year, this man's not even going to make it to the end of the year. Quit thinking about 8 years. The fact that this man looks like he's not even going to make it to the end of the year, still standing behind that right now. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on the Fiery Camp at our official homes, TFY, cpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/TFY CPO. You can listen on the go. Just download the Bobby Knapp at the iTunes Store or the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available at the iTunes Store and on Podbean. Just search for the fire you can't put out there. You can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, just a general statement or inquiry. You can email us at TFYCPO@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and thank you for listening. This is Melvin, signing off. Now that I've woken you up, good morning.